Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 9th of March. Our guest this hour is the author of a fascinating book, Commander in Chief, How Truman, Johnson, and Bush Turned a Presidential Power into a Threat to America's Future. It's a story of three unwinnable wars, and our guest says that the end result will be that in another generation, roughly 25 years from now, the global war on terror will still be underway. He talks about the last classical war, World War II. For more than 200 years, major wars had clear beginnings and clear endings. Since 1945, we've had a new kind of revolutionary wars, wars that develop rather than erupt, wars without declarations of wars, wars without surrenders. Their beginnings are murky, their conclusions unclear. They are tests of stamina rather than strength, and they are more likely than not to sow the seeds of future wars. Jeffrey Perret is with us. The book is Commander in Chief, How Truman, Johnson, and Bush Turned a Presidential Power into a Threat to America's Future. He is also the author of a number of other books, including Old Soldiers Never Die, The Life of Douglas MacArthur, Ulysses S. Grant, Soldier and President, Eisenhower, and Lincoln's War, The Untold Story of America's Greatest President as Commander-in-Chief. He's been a contributor and consultant to documentaries on PBS, on C-SPAN, on Fox News, and on the History Channel. And I'm sure you're going to find this a fascinating discussion, so join in whenever you'd like. Pick any of the presidents, Truman, Johnson, or Bush, any of the wars, and we'd love to hear your comments. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Hello, Jeffrey. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah,
nice to have you here. Let's start with Truman. We don't spend a whole lot of time talking about the Korean War, and I'm glad you included him here because we can brush up on our history. Truman made the decision, you write, to intervene in Korea without consulting anyone?
That's right. The only person he consulted, in effect, was Dean Acheson.
Why?
Because the military had a strategy for the Western Pacific at the end of World War II, which said, if we hold the string of islands from the Aleutians to Japan to Okinawa down to the Philippines and Australia with air and naval bases, we won't have to put a single American soldier on the Asian mainland. We'll be able to secure all of our political and economic interests in the region without the risk of a land war and being involved in a land war in Asia. And Acheson convinced Truman that the U.S. could not leave Korea, which that strategy called for. And but the military objected, and so there were 500 American military trainers or advisors in South Korea, but they came under the State Department, which was run by Dean Acheson, and not under the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
And when Truman made the decision to intervene in Korea, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff were present at that meeting, they were not asked a single question.
Hmm. Could you remind us of what was going on in the country at that time as well, that these presidents were responding to the domestic mood? There was a lot of concern on Capitol Hill over who lost China. We had McCarthy going on at this time as well. How did this play into Truman's decision?
Well, I think you find that in all three of these wars, the politics that the American presidents were concerned with was domestic politics. They seemed to have been more or less oblivious to international politics or geopolitics. And Truman, I think it is fair to say, was somewhat intimidated by the China lobby, which he was always going to have investigated and bring and have various people prosecuted for corruption. But he never really had the nerve to do it, nor would he really confront Joseph McCarthy. And but I have a feeling that even without that, even had there been no McCarthyite scares and no hysteria in Congress over who supposedly lost China, that Truman would still have intervened in Korea simply because it meant asserting American power.
Mm-hmm. Did he have a goal? Did he have a strategy, an end game?
Truman had formulated his view of what the United States should do after World War II, even before the war ended, and that was his responsibility as president was to maintain America's position in the world as the most military, the most powerful country. And that way, nobody would pose a serious challenge, or so he believed. But he didn't allow for the fact that American power was bound to decline in relative terms, not absolute terms, but bound to decline as other countries recovered from World War II. Mm. So what he was seeking to do was simply impossible.
Mm-hmm. And you write about all of these presidents not really seeking the advice of people who probably knew more than they did about the situation. Was that true of Truman? Did he have anybody who was really smart advising him about what to do in Korea?
Well, he had Dean Acheson.
That was it.
That was more or less it. And Dean Acheson these days is rated very highly by everyone, it seems, except me.
And you, of course, are right.
Well, I only know what I know.
Exactly. And you know a lot.
And Dean Acheson had a view of the United States that said the United States is the locomotive of mankind, and the rest of the planet is the caboose.
Hmm.
Well, I think that is a dangerous road to take in international affairs.
Mm-hmm. Let's move to Johnson. The assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the impact on the American psyche, affected the emotionally volatile Johnson as much as anyone. How does that tie into his decisions in Vietnam, Jeffrey?
Well, Johnson believed that, or liked to believe, that what he was doing was continuing with John Kennedy's policies in Southeast Asia. But he did not know what John Kennedy's thinking was. He was not a confidant. And the people who were close to Kennedy believed, most of them, and on the basis of things that John Kennedy said to them, that Kennedy's intention was to try to neutralize South Vietnam after the 1964 election. If he was reelected, he would then be in a position to do that. And he'd already arrived at an agreement with the Russians to neutralize Laos. And so the other side would know that Kennedy had no objections to neutralism in Southeast Asia. And I'm convinced that that was what Kennedy intended to do, but he never talked to Johnson about anything in international affairs.
And Johnson wanted to carry on what he thought Kennedy would do. Why? Because it would get him reelected, or...?
I think he felt a moral obligation. Mm. I mean, look at all that domestic legislation that John Kennedy could not get through the Congress, but Johnson committed himself absolutely to getting that legislation passed, and that worked. And so there is a parallel between domestic and foreign policy here.
Mm-hmm. In the end, you write how true this is. Even Johnson couldn't make sense of why he had done what he did.
Well, it's true.
Yeah.
Because there was no truly rational case for fighting a major war in Southeast Asia, and there was even less rationality in fighting the way that he did.
Mm-hmm. What about this whole domino theory that was so prevalent at that time? What did Johnson say about that, and what about that as a motivation? You know, if Vietnam goes, then China gets more powerful, all the other countries are going to go communist. It was such a simplistic analysis of the world, but it was so accepted by so many people.
That's true, but I don't see that so much as a motivation as an excuse.
Hmm.
Nothing really to back it up. It said, well, if we don't do this, we will lose credibility with our allies. Well, there's hardly an American ally among the liberal democracies that believed that what the U.S. Was doing in South Vietnam made any sense. And when the war was over, they were very glad.
Who was advising Johnson? McNamara?
McNamara and Rusk, the most important person in advising Johnson, Advising Johnson, though, to a large degree, consisted of telling him he was right. The most important figure was Dean Rusk.
And your assessment of him?
My assessment of Dean Rusk is as scathing as my assessment of Dean Acheson. I think they were both highly overrated, and they had a veneer of sophistication, but that was as far as it went.
Yeah. And what about this? It's kind of this thread in all of these presidencies of listening to advisors, and the reason for the advisors is to validate what it is that the president wants to do, that you're listening to people who are yes people, in a sense.
Well, the king always has his courtiers. And the way you establish your power is by being closer to the throne than the next guy.
What about the intelligence of all three of these presidents? You write about Johnson, and certainly we've heard so much about Bush that maybe they needed to depend a lot more on their advisors because Johnson's forte was domestic policy. Bush didn't seem to know very much about foreign affairs when he became president. None of them really, maybe Truman more of a reader than the other two, but they weren't really engaged in the world. They read the newspapers, but they weren't reading heavy-duty stuff on an analysis of Korea or China or Iraq or Vietnam.
Well, I would think Johnson was a very intelligent man, but that does not mean to say that he was intellectually sophisticated. He had very little in the way of analytical skills. And as a result, like Truman before him and Bush after him, you did not get reasoning from Johnson. What you got was clichés.
What about Truman?
Well, the same thing was true with Truman. He had a very simplistic view of the world. Truman was, I think Truman was a fairly intelligent man. But, you know, there are two areas here when it comes to presidential leadership or almost any kind of leadership. You have to look at both somebody's temperament and their intelligence. Truman had Truman's temperament excites admiration, but Truman's intellectual abilities certainly don't. In the case of Johnson, I think he was brighter than people gave him credit for being, but he was let down by his temperament. And in the case of something similar, I think it's a similar case with George Bush.
Brought down by his temperament?
Yeah, I think he's a smarter person than most people are willing to give him credit for being.
Really?
Yeah.
Let's go to Iraq for a moment. Americans needed an Arab and Muslim country, you write, after September 11th, on which to take revenge. Bush's visceral response, can we attack Iraq? Why was that the question?
Well, the reason why George Bush wanted to be president was in order to attack Iraq. This was not something that came to him after he became president, still less after September 11th. I've found four people who are all reputable, impeccable witnesses, including someone who is the Bush family biographer, Mickey Herskovitz. Before Bush even got the Republican nomination, he was telling people, if I get to be president, I'm going to invade Iraq and overthrow Saddam Hussein. And I think it has a lot to do with his father and something to do with Laura Bush. Because there was a supposed assassination plot that the Kuwaitis foiled when George Herbert Walker Bush, the first President Bush, went to Kuwait. And had there really been such a plot, I'm very skeptical about this, but had there really been such a plot and it been put into effect, then a car with 200 pounds of Semtex would have been driven into the presidential limousine. Well, the limousine right behind would have contained Laura Bush. So not only would Bush's father have been assassinated, but so would Laura Bush.
Oh, my. Let's welcome phone calls. We have a lot to take on here with our guest. We're talking with the author of Commander-in-Chief, How Truman, Johnson, and Bush Turned a Presidential Power into a Threat to America's Future. And we'll talk in greater detail about what that threat is. Jeffrey Perret is our guest. Jeffrey has written a number of other books, a number of other books about presidents, and he, in a lot of them, have won awards. He's written about Douglas MacArthur in Old Soldiers Never Die, The Life of Douglas MacArthur, Ulysses S. Grant, Soldier and President, a book on Eisenhower, and Lincoln's War, The Untold Story of America's Greatest Commander-in-Chief. And he has also, I neglected to say, written a book on John Kennedy titled Jack. All right, to you in a moment, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The phone calls now for Jeffrey Perret. The book is Commander-in-Chief, How Truman, Johnson, and Bush Turned a Presidential Power into a Threat to America's Future. One line is open if you'd like to grab it. It is yours. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. And we start our calls with David from Madison. Hi, David.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think the biggest difference between these three wars is that in Korea and Vietnam, those were ongoing wars that we chose to get involved in, whereas the Iraq war is a war that Bush chose to start. It's a war of aggression, which makes it different. I think that a similarity between this war and Vietnam is that it's going to take a committed anti-war movement to end it, which is why people from all over the state are coming to Madison on St. Patrick's Day, a week from tomorrow, 12:30 at the Library Mall end of State Street, and we're going to demonstrate and keep demonstrating until our leaders get the message and end this war.
Jeffrey.
Well, I take a different view of the Iraq war. As far as I'm concerned, this is a war that began in 1991. And one might note that the justification that the administration had given for the invasion of Iraq was the resolutions that were passed in 1990 and 1991. And really, that was the what was called the liberation of Kuwait was simply the first stage in a war that was always likely to run for decades. So to me, this is just year 15 of a war that began in 1991.
Hmm. David, anything else? Thanks very much for your call. Fred is next from Palmyra. Hi, Fred.
Good morning.
Hi.
I hope your guests can straighten me out on this. I always thought that one of the main reasons we got involved in Vietnam was because Eisenhower signed a document called the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, and that we were committed to getting involved there, and partly because France got beat up over there, so we went in because they were our ally or something?
That's not quite the way I would say it. The CETO Treaty was written, really, in the State Department, and Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles certainly pushed it very hard. However, all the CETO treaty called for was that if one of the parties to the treaty came under attack, that there would have to be a conference with the other signatories. It did not call for military intervention. People said, well, it's like NATO. But if you look at the NATO treaty, virtually the first thing it says is an attack upon one shall be considered an attack upon all. That language does not appear in the CETO Treaty. There's nothing like that kind of commitment. And most of the CETO signatories did not send troops to Vietnam. I mean, Britain was a signatory. France was a signatory. Pakistan was a signatory.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Fred, for the call. 800-486-8655. Nathan from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I guess my question was, or comment, was in reaction to what the author said about it being a wrong approach in foreign affairs to consider that America is a locomotive and the rest of the world the caboose. And all I can say is for 50-odd years, the American taxpayer has paid for and ensured global security and stability all over the world. Everybody else has been able to prosper economically on the back of American protection. And I think it's a dishonor to say that's the wrong approach.
Jeffrey.
Well, I think if you took it, if you looked at around the world since 1945, you would find there has been very little stability and security. And at the moment, I don't think anybody would describe what we have as a world that is stable and secure.
Mm-hmm. There's a part of the book that's received a lot of attention, the end of the book, that China, the only country to have gained strategic advantages from America's three unwinnable wars, the United States has gained nothing, not even the gratitude of South Korea. Iraq will break American power. Hello, China.
Yes. Well, I believe that that is the case. Not just because many years ago, when I was a graduate student, I studied Chinese. All great nations eventually blunder into disaster, and what looks like a comparatively simple challenge turns out to be a wound that keeps on bleeding and bleeding and bleeding.
Hmm. How will Iraq break American power, Jeffrey?
Well, the first thing to say, I suppose, is that the way you win wars is by winning them politically. The U.S. keeps trying to win them militarily.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we are playing into the hands of our enemies. And Iraq, I think, assuming President Bush does not bomb Iran in the closing months of his term of office, assuming that that doesn't happen, it will be at least the generation, I think, before the U.S. Is ready psychologically to fight another war. And the U.S. will still have enormous destructive power. But its power to shape events has already been considerably reduced. And after failure in Iraq, and what I suspect will turn out to be failure in Afghanistan, that power will continue to shrivel. And, of course, there is something else. The U.S. could not go to war with China now without getting the Chinese to loan it the money to pay for the war.
Right, right. Do you think the administration is seriously considering bombing Iran?
Absolutely.
You do?
Oh, yes. They're both planning, and there have been some practice.
And what is it, when you talk about Iraq breaking American power, what are the consequences of that? What happens to the stature of the position of America in the world? What does it mean to not have power?
Well, the U.S. will still have power. It will still be a rich and powerful country. What I'm talking about is the use of power to shape things to suit American interests and values. I think that power it hasn't gone yet, but we're very close to it.
Mm-hmm.
The great challenge that Truman faced after 1945 was the management of relative decline. Not comparative decline, but relative decline. And unless that transition is managed intelligently and effectively, then that could indeed turn into the loss of absolute power.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. has enormous destructive power. But what do? You can, these days, with the Internet and television and so on, you can't go out and kill large numbers of people as a solution to the problem. That's unacceptable.
Mm-hmm. And how has China gained strategic advantages from all of these wars?
Well, in Korea, China turned Korea into a trap, and the U.S. is still, by intervening as it did and defeating defeating an American army. That gave the new Chinese regime, the communist regime, strength and confidence, and across the Third World, a great deal of admiration. And even before the Korean War was ended, Mao was already planning to send Chinese assistance or aid to Vietnam, to the Viet Minh. And it was with that assistance that it was possible for General Giap to take Dien Bien Phu. Well, so China gained its strategic goals in in Korea, the most important of which was a determination to be taken seriously. And in Vietnam, the only way Richard Nixon could get the United States out of Vietnam was by going to China and asking for Chinese help in withdrawing American troops. So the Chinese have gained from those two wars. They're gaining from the Iraq war, if only by virtue of the way the world has been alienated from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
China is now more popular on a worldwide basis than America.
Hmm.
And as I say, these struggles are political rather than military.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, for Nathan, for your phone call. Let's go to Mark next from Milwaukee. Hello, Mark.
excuse me. I just was reading The Arrogance of Power by William Fulbright, mm-hmm. written in the late 1960s. And it clearly applies to the war in Iraq, especially the last chapter. But my one comment was, I think Eisenhower is an underrated president because of his ability to focus on what was important, along with Dulles and his, Ridgway, his military friend and commander-in-chief, because he put together NATO, and he, I don't believe we would have gotten involved in Vietnam if Eisenhower had had a third term. And he really did focus on what was important, and I would you made the comments about Acheson and Rusk, and I wondered what you think about John Foster Dulles.
Well, to a degree that is underappreciated, in my view, Eisenhower was his own Secretary of State. Hmm. He had far more experience of war and peace and dealing with the most powerful people in the world than Dulles had. Dulles was useful as Secretary of State, and Dulles also took a lot of the heat that Eisenhower might have had to deal with. But Dulles was an excellent heat shield for Eisenhower.
Thanks very much for the call. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. Jeffrey Perret is our guest. He is the author of Commander-in-Chief, How Truman, Johnson, and Bush Turned a Presidential Power into a Threat to America's Future. He looks at the story, the book is about the story of ever-expanding presidential powers in an age of unwinnable wars. Harry Truman and Korea, Lyndon Johnson and Vietnam, and George W. Bush and Iraq. And jump into any of those wars that you'd like to, or what they all mean for sowing the seeds of future wars, which we'll ask Jeffrey about in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655-227-2050. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 227-2050. You would have thought, Jeffrey, that after a while, after three of these, that that haven't gone very well, that cost a lot of money, and in some cases a huge number of people died, that somebody would sort of look at this and say, we need a new model. This just doesn't seem to be working out very well for us. Why do we keep doing the same wrong thing?
Well, I fear that the myth of American exceptionalism has become a very dangerous force. And that Dean Acheson quote was a perfect expression of that belief in American exceptionalism. It's a view that says, once the U.S. has made up its mind to do something, it is so rich and so powerful that success is virtually guaranteed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's there's a name for it, hubris.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that hubris ends badly.
Mm-hmm. And tell me in greater detail what you mean when you talk about that we're misreading the moment. Since World War II, wars have become a test of stamina rather than strength, and are more likely than not sowing the seeds of future wars. How so?
Because the most influential military thinker of the 20th century was Mao Zedong.
Hmm.
And with his doctrine of protracted war, and his very simple tactics. But the key to what Mao saw was that he looked at the Chinese peasantry, the most impoverished, downtrodden people in the country, and saw within them an enormous force if you could only mobilize it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chinese communists learned how to mobilize it, and as a result, they took control of the country from a much bigger military force that was well-equipped and well-financed. And that example has been spread across the global South. The peasants are not helpless, that history was wrong about that. Nearly all peasant revolts failed, but these are not peasant revolts.
Mm-hmm.
These become popular movements, and are passed down from one generation to the next. So you can appear to have defeated one of these insurgencies, and 2 years later, well, the Battle of Algiers made this point. It shows that the French managed to torture their way to what they thought was victory. And 2 years later, by capturing and torturing and killing the leaders of the Algerian resistance, but 2 years later, they had a new revolt on their hands that appeared to have no leadership at all. It seemed to be entirely spontaneous. And the French had no answer to that, except let's leave.
Hmm. And so the way to handle insurgencies in the future is politically?
Absolutely. There's really no other way. Here's the conundrum. In order to achieve a military success, you must first have a political success.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to achieve a political success, you must first have a military success. So, now, this is, to my mind, one of the greatest challenges in triangulation that humanity has devised. It is possible, but it's very, very difficult. And you cannot, there is a point, in effect, where you more or less have to stop killing people when it comes to dealing with an insurgency.
Mm.
And you have to start talking to them
mm-hmm.
instead of trying to kill them. I'm not sure that in Afghanistan and Iraq, the U.S. has reached that point yet.
Yeah. No, far from it. It's hard to imagine that happening, isn't it?
Well, I would like to believe that it could be done.
Hmm.
But there is a problem here, and it is force protection. The first duty of American commanders is to protect their troops, and the way force protection is practiced is that the least sign of trouble. You know, you call in the Air Force, and they just bomb wherever the firing is coming from,
mm-hmm.
even though that almost always involves killing a lot of people who are not insurgents.
Yes. Yes. Let's go back to phone calls. Judy is next from Milwaukee. Hello, Judy.
Hello. I'm currently reading a book by Chalmers Johnson called Nemesis, and it seems to me that he poses the idea that a standing army and a military-industrial complex in which manufacture of military weaponry is the prime thing that we do in this country leads inevitably to perpetual war, the kind of thing that Eisenhower warned against, and George Washington, apparently. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are, that this is, in essence, inevitable, since we have a standing army of paid people who do this as their work, and the only manufacturing we do, really, is things that have to do with military activity.
Hmm.
That is true, but I do believe that failures and defeats and retreats have an effect upon the character of a country. And I believe that failure and defeat in Iraq and probably Afghanistan will undermine this military-industrial complex and having a large permanent military. Will come to be seen as something too expensive, too wasteful. The U.S. is resisting, in effect, a global trend, which is a move against away from war. The U.N. was created in order to stop or to bring to a close wars between states. On that basis, the U.S. has been phenomenally successful. There are hardly any wars between states anymore. What we have instead are U.N. peacekeepers in 17 or 18 countries. The U.S. is probably, along with Israel, the only country that still believes that war can be a force for good.
Wow. That's quite a statement. I'm trying to think of other countries that could fit that category.
Well, who else has gone to war with other states in the last 10 years?
Right. Are you finished, Judy, or do you have more?
No, that was an overwhelming thought, to think that I live in a country that and pay taxes to a country that believes that war is a force for good. I will have to absorb that. Thank you.
Thanks, Judy, for your call. Let's go next to Frank from Fond du Lac. Hello, Frank.
Yeah, I think 2 points. One, Bush fundamentally misunderstood the nature of a terrorist attack. And anyone, including people like Richard Clark, told him, but he didn't listen. In a terrorist attack, the target is never the objective. The objective is to get the target nation to overreact and to act on poor intelligence. And by overreacting, they alienate the real targets of the terrorist attack. So by attacking Iraq, rounding up Muslims all across the United States, by violating our Constitution, that was truly the objective of the 9/11 attack. The other comment is, what happened in this administration was, in a way that's profoundly different from any other administration, the national security policymaking process was completely destroyed. You had people inside the military and inside the intelligence were coming to Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld and telling them over and over again, there is not a link between Iraq and the attacks. There are no weapons of mass destruction. This is not going to be easy. You don't have enough troops.
All right. Thanks, Nate, for the call. Jeffrey?
Well, I agree with much of that. But it is also the case that, in effect, the U.S. was still at war with Iraq before September 11. There were these bombing operations, and one of them was hoped would force Saddam Hussein to do something that would justify an invasion of Iraq. And there was even talk of having a white airplane painted in UN colors and more or less pushing the Iraqis in to try to shoot it down. Well, that didn't work. So this did not just begin on September 11th. As for the terrorist tactic of trying to provoke an overreaction, it's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
And strangely enough, Donald Rumsfeld once gave a speech shortly after he became Secretary of Defense. He said that the American response to attacks like the one on the coal is either to do nothing or to overreact.
More phone calls in a moment. Jeffrey Perret is our guest. His book is Commander-in-Chief, How Truman, Johnson, and Bush Turned a Presidential Power into a Threat to America's Future. We have a couple lines open. If you've been trying to join us, this would be just a great time for you to do so. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At the second hour of our program, you're going to get a rare look at the sexual and romantic lives of America's young people. Laura Sessions Stepp will be joining us. The last time we spoke with her was about her last book, Our Last Best Shot, which looked very deeply at the lives of young people ages 10 to 15. This book is Unhooked, How Young Women Pursue Sex, Delay Love, and Lose at Both. That's coming up the next hour. Jeffrey Perret is here now. Our number is 800-486-8655. Jack from Oak Creek, hi.
Hello. I wonder, could your guest comment on I was in 2 years in Vietnam, and I realize eventually after 10 years we could not defeat these people in their black pajamas and their little grass huts and this sort of thing with all our high-tech weapons. We're not able to do it now in Iraq and Baghdad with our high-tech weapons when it comes to house fighting, this sort of thing. And I get the feeling the only way we can take on Iran, if that happens, is it's going to have to be an air war with high-tech cruise missiles and all sorts of nuclear small yield weapons, this sort of thing. How do you see us possibly fighting the next war, and apparently now with Iran, and because we go from war to a war, and what do you think is the next war if it's not Iran?
Well, I think the intention is to wage an aerial assault on Iran, and there might be some small ground unit operations. It's mostly going to be a bombing campaign aimed at the 300 or so nuclear and nuclear-related sites. But the planning has been scaled up recently to include about 200 military sites as well, you know, warehouses, barracks, bases, and so on. So the Air Force is being asked to wage an air campaign against about 500 targets.
I'm sorry.
Oh, and the consequences of that, I suspect, would be felt even before the first bomb had been dropped, because it would be impossible to keep something like that secret. And secondly,
right,
there's going to have to be a five-day air campaign against Iranian air defenses. So we will know 2-3 weeks before it starts. And in those 2-3 weeks, I suspect the price of oil will go to about $10 a gallon.
Well, factor in, please, Jeffrey, the American public in this, because there is a great deal of outrage about the war in Iraq right now. The president's approval ratings are way, way down. How could the administration do this kind of action without the American public being just up in arms?
Well, they may be up in arms, but they can't stop it.
Hmm.
When in the closing days of the Nixon administration, there was some fear that Nixon, because he was drinking heavily and feeling very sorry for himself, might decide to unleash a nuclear war on Russia. And a way was found to ensure that three people had to sign off on it. The president couldn't do it on his own. And the other two were sure to, in effect, exercise a veto. But I can't see anything like that happening now. So the president could, in effect, give a direct order to the Air Force to do this. What the Air Force reaction would be, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about this Nixon thing. I wasn't aware of that. Who arranged this deal? Who signed off?
His Secretary of Defense at the time, and the Secretary Secretary of State. They got Congress to agree that something called the National Command Authority would be established, and only the National Command Authority would have the authority to order the use of nuclear weapons.
Hmm. Thanks very much for your call, Jack. Let's go next to Bill from Deerfield. Hello, Bill.
Hi. Well, you just talked about Iran, and that's what I wanted to talk about. So I guess I'll just comment on what you said, Kathleen. We got to change what we're doing. We're making these mistakes over and over again. And before the Iraq War, this battle of it, I guess the way your guests would describe it, 50% of the people in this country were against it, but only about 5% of the news coverage showed those faces and those experts. 90%+ of the corporate news was the cheerleaders. So we've got some work to do there.
Jeffrey?
Well, my recollection is that polls taken at the end of March 2003 show that 75% of the public supported it, the invasion of Iraq. About 20% were opposed, and 5% were undecided, and it reminded me of being in college in 1964, 65, when there were similar polls about Vietnam. And over the course of time, you know, those numbers changed. But initially, there was a lot of support for the Vietnam War, and there was tremendous support for the invasion of Iraq.
Okay. Well, hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay. By the end of March, you may have been right. But this was after the drumbeat of 60 days of nothing but pro-war experts and an uncritical examination of Colin Powell's presentation at the United Nations. Other voices were not allowed onto our corporate media, and of course public opinion did go from about 50-50 to 75-25. But that's my point.
Hmm. Well, I agree with you that the coverage of the newspapers and television... Mm-hmm. During the build-up to the invasion, and in the first 2 years thereafter, was simply abysmal.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of things that were known among journalists that were never ever published. There were a lot of things that Europeans could see on television that were never shown here.
Mm-hmm.
There were things on the internet that people could see, and the rest of the world was watching this. And to this day, there are some of the most horrifying photographs of what happened in Abu Ghraib have never been shown by media in the United States. But if you access a Pakistani newspaper, you can see them.
Yeah. We're going to welcome more phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. You know, and it seems to me when we were talking earlier about people advising Truman and Johnson and Bush and whether or not they were up to speed and had keen minds looking at various parts of the world in which they were about to engage American troops, you know, I got to tell you that we did a whole lot of programs many years ago, Jeffrey, with a lot of Middle Eastern scholars who had very, very strong reservations about actions, who had a deep understanding of the history of this part of the world, who really informed, I think, public radio audiences in a pretty complete way. But when this, let's rally around the flag, let's rally around the president, there's a very strong impulse on the part of the American people to do just that, rather than sitting back and understanding, feeding their minds with knowledge about history.
Well, to my mind, patriotism has to meet the pragmatism test.
Mm.
If you can say you're patriotic and salute the flag and sing the Stars and Stripes, but if it turns out that what you've supported has been wrong, mm-hmm. and possibly illegal, I don't think that counts as patriotism. Is really the best thing for your country.
Mm. Thanks, Bill, for the call. Bill from Tomahawk. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I wanted to try this thought on your guest, and he's sure a smart guy. The first two wars, Korea and Vietnam, were fought for more or less ideological reasons, fear of communism. But the Iraq War is the first corporate war. And it really represents the advance of corporate interests, corporate America, and oil is at the bottom of it. And anybody that can deny it isn't seeing it.
Jeffrey,
well, in my view, this really comes down to something personal. Sure, the oil companies have an interest in it. But if George W. Bush had not already come to the White House determined to attack Iraq, I'm not sure that it would have happened.
Hmm.
Now, once American troops are in Iraq, indeed, oil becomes really important. But they've done anything but secure it, because Iraqi oil production now is only a little more than half what it was under Saddam Hussein.
Do any of these guys... I only have about 30 seconds for this, but you wonder about whether or not they're looking at the loss of life, which is a result of all these endeavors, and does it weigh heavily on them at all?
I seriously doubt it.
Hmm.
I would like to say, yeah, they're human like the rest of us, But powerful people have all kinds of emotional defenses against that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to function.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeffrey, so much for the hour. It was most interesting.
Well, thank you very much.
Jeffrey Perret, Commander-in-Chief, is his book, How Truman, Johnson, and Bush Turned a Presidential Power into a Threat to America's Future. It has recently been published. Hold on, let me look at the publisher, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. So that's who published it. He's also the author, maybe you've read some of his other books, Old Soldiers Never Die, The Life of Douglas MacArthur, Ulysses S. Grant, Soldier and President, Eisenhower. He wrote a book, Jack, on John Kennedy and Lincoln's War, The Untold Story of America's Greatest President as Commander-in-Chief. He's been a contributor and consultant to documentaries on PBS, C-SPAN, Fox News, and also the History Channel. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in lovely Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we'll return with more Friday Conversation. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.